Hi, I'm Michelle Olivier, and you're listening to Hey, I Want Your Job, the podcast that looks at amazing jobs and what it takes to get them. Welcome to Hey, I Want Your Job. And today I am joined by somebody whose job made me laugh, made me smile, and actually made me cry a little bit because we have a lot in common. Bobby, what's your job title? For the purposes of this interview.
I am by trade an aerial sequence designer, which I design aerial sequences for Broadway shows, musicals, cruise ships, rock concerts, and I basically paint with the human body in the middle of, in midair. I was a
which is amazing artist.
I was a trapeze artist, so I combined my theater work and circus together, and I also run a circus training facility, and I coach actors and actors and actresses for Broadway shows.
Which is all amazing, but that was not the part that made me laugh, cry.
Yes, and I'm a first-time author. Yes.
And you're an author. And what is the title of your book?
The title of my book is hashtag shit my mama says. Now, why is it hashtag shit my mama says? Long story. We'll get into that. Do you want me to tell the little backstory?
Tell the short version.
Yeah, I'll tell the abbreviated version. So for the past, mom was in the nursing home for 6 years. And when she got into the nursing home, she had many catchphrases. And every time she came out with one, I would share it on the internet with the hashtag shit my mama says. Well, actually, today, March 21st, my mother passed away. And so I went and compiled all of her sayings and put them into this little book of quotes. And it's just our story together as mother and son. It started out as her eulogy, and it ended up, I just said, this needs to be something. And when I came up with the idea of a small book, I thought, okay, great. But the response has been amazing from caregivers, from people who are dealing with a spouse with dementia, people who had parents who passed from dementia. It takes them right back there to when their parents were going through it. And then they would send me their parents' shit their parents said. I even have an annex that I was going to add to the book called Shit My Grandma Says, because my mother and grandmother, you know, the apple does not fall far from the tree. And I'm a stand-up comic. So on top of all of this now. So, you know, we all have our catchphrases. And I just put them all together because I needed to memorialize her in a way that was never done before in that way. And just because it needed to be heard, you know, like you said, it made you laugh, it made you tear up, but it is just the little book that could. And it's been selling pretty well all worldwide, believe it or not. My mom's words are now in 5 countries that she's never traveled to. New Zealand, Australia, UK, Germany, Mexico. She's in Canada as well. So it's like, she's all over. And I'm blessed that those people are getting something out of this tiny little book that was just my little project.
I just love it so much. So my dad died 6 days before my oldest son was born. And he was like your mom, shall we say, a character. I always say my dad was my favorite asshole. And like, I think that's probably most people who knew my father agree that that's a great way to refer to my dad. You would never call my dad nice. It was just often right, occasionally kind, but inevitably entertaining. And he also, like your mom, had catchphrases. And so I know when he passed, like he died of cancer, and he granted one last wish to each of the kids before he died. And my brother asked for his catchphrases to be immortalized in signs to have in their home for their kids to grow up with. So he has one that says, recipes, we don't need no stinking recipes. Mm-hmm. He has one that says, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. And he has one that says, how hard can it be? Because those were the three things that my dad lived by, absolutely. And you can't fix stupid. But that was already somebody else's catchphrase. So, you know,
Mom had a few that she borrowed as well.
Yeah.
It doesn't, as long, originally I always say, as long as you credit the person who said it first, but who knows who said those things first,
Absolutely.
it could have come over on the Mayflower. We even, I was like, what are we doing here? You can't fix stupid, it just, you never know.
So you're putting this together. What I hear from you were telling the story is that it was part of your own healing and your
Yes.
own grappling with things. So I picture as I was reading it, I felt like I could see you writing it and you laughing and you crying as you were compiling it. And I feel like it does such a great job of transferring that emotion over to the person. Is that something you hear a lot? Is that something you feel when you like go back and read passages?
Here's the thing. Trauma, no matter when it happens, whenever you retell the story, you relive it. And part of healing is being able to be comfortable with the passage of what happened. And so reading it over again, I mean, I had to read it hundreds of times before it was edited, and then it's been edited a couple times since, so it's like I had a point of view. I even took out some quotes that only made sense to me. They were only funny to me. And anybody reading them, there are even some in there that are in there now that people are like, oh, okay, I don't quite get what she's saying, but I know it's funny. But it's when you relive that time period, it's a gift back to you that the good of the good times. So you have that, you have the opportunity to say good morning to your mom every day, when she see you, she's right there. And it just gives me it gave me a chance to process everything. Death is horrible. Death is harsh. There is nothing pleasant about death. There's nothing pleasant about seeing a dead body, especially the body that gave you life. When I, my father died of lung cancer when I was in my 20s. He waited for me until we were alone together to die. Like he waited for me specifically. They said, Bobby, you better get here. He's not going to make it. And that was, I was like, I wasn't stuck in a weekend where I couldn't get off from work. My boss was a real asshole at that point. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I say asshole on you?
I can say asshole, it's fine.
My boss was evil, like absolutely hateful human being. Finally, 5 days had gone by and I said, I'm going to see my father. You can fire me. And the day that I got there, I sat in bed with him. We watched two movies. We watched Grease because we went to see Grease together. And then I think Olivia and John killed him, really. He just took his last breath right while I'm sitting there with him. And I felt him just leave. I felt him float away. And the, when a person dies, it's not like the movies. It's not like they take their last breath, they close their eyes, they close their mouth, then their arms are crossed over their chest. No, they look like they do in the morgue. It's horrible. It's a horrible visual. That's why one of the things that I up leading up to mom's passing, I had found two really great YouTube channels about death and the death industry. One is Carrie the Mortician. She is a mortician in, I believe, Wisconsin. Oh, no, Minnesota. And I'm going to be on her show soon too, actually. We're going to do a cooking thing. We're going to make sangria together. And the other is Caitlin Doughty, Ask a Mortician. And what both of those channels did, now you and I were talking in the pre-chat that I loved the chats you did with the horror team and the paranormal team, the Soul Sisters, and I love that stuff, but I also was fascinated by death even as a child because it was just confusing and it happened constantly because I was raised on a family farm, so I was used to waking up and oh, one of the chickens is gone, oh, one of the dogs died, oh, your hamster's dead, or there was just like this circle. And then it became people. And then there were the funerals, and then it was like, oh my God, why does that person look like wax? You know, or why is my dad smirking in the casket? You know, there's so, and then when you hear like the embalming process and all that, like, oh my God, it's like human taxidermy.
Yes.
But you don't realize it at the time. You know, you want that ritual, you want the family together to comfort you, and you want to say goodbye to the loved one who's passed. But there's nothing that prepares you for what a dead body actually looks like. But those two women, both in their channels, have given people the opportunity to be able to deal with their own mortality, but also to deal with the funeral industry, which is a business. And, you know, like every time you go through, even burying my mother's ashes was difficult. Because it's still breaking the ground. It still has to have a vault. It still has to be, you know, X number of feet down. It still has to have, the tombstone has to be done. You know, all these things that had to be done ahead of time. So they don't tell you that that's like you're going to the store and you're just buying something for a dead body. So it's hard to, but it prepared me to walk into the funeral home and say direct cremation alternative container, which basically means no frills, no, and we couldn't have a ceremony. We literally were not allowed into the funeral home unless they came to the door, walked us into a small room, we signed the papers, and that was it. Mom was there within a few hours. She went to the crematory after that, but then she was stuck there for a couple of weeks because we had this surge in deaths. There were refrigerator trucks outside of every funeral home. There were refrigerator trucks outside of every hospital because there were so many people that were dying, like minutes apart. They would, it was just too many people, and it was happening so fast. And then the next day, March 22nd, I woke up with COVID. So that's how we knew how she passed. And we knew because all the symptoms matched up, the timing matched up. And then I woke up with it. So it was the scariest time of my life. I don't want to relive it, but I do. And it's like when somebody asks, I envision this is what it feels like for a victim of a crime. Whenever you're in the deposition seat, whenever you're on the stand, you're repeating it and reliving it over and over again, that trauma. For me, going through my mom's process, I was sad, and I was still like, you know, taken aback by the way that she looked when I saw her last, but also comforted that I had the wherewithal in my brain to write it down, to write everything down, to keep every memory of her alive. And she's alive every day. Like I said, she's in more countries now than she's never visited. So
I love that. So my mom has dementia. And it's so I identify with so much of what you said. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's really hard, my mom was to say that my mom was a force of nature would be like unjust to forces of nature, right? That's not selling it enough for what my mom was in her prime. And she is not that anymore. And it's really, really hard. And she next, you know, growing up her next to my dad, who, like I said, was my favorite asshole, she wasn't the pithy one. She wasn't the showman, right? She was the quiet, sane, incredibly competent one, quietly puppet mastering in the background. And so one of the things that, you know, I felt and was really like that touched me about the book was having these jewels to hold on to of great moments with your mom of like shit that she said that you're like, oh, that's so mom. And there's just like there's fewer of those with mom. I think my favorite thing my mom ever said, the one that kind of resonates in the family, is my dad was married before her. And we asked her one time, we're like, well, mom, what did dad's first wife look like? Like, was she pretty? And my mom kind of thought for a second and she went, well, I mean, She wasn't like horribly disfigured or anything. Just like that right there. Or I think that says it all about how you felt about Dad's first wife. All right, Mom, thanks for that. But it's really, you know, I am struggling with watching her be less every time I engage. And I struggle with something that I felt like you did really well, which is to embrace what is there now. And I would love to hear some tips from you because my best friend is great at it. My mom is in this place where, like, every story my mom tells, every story about present day, past day, and of course, she doesn't remember what's present and what's past anymore, right? So that's all basically yesterday that it happened to her, involves, as my best friend puts it, somebody wanting to tap that ass. So, like, everything comes back to how somebody thought she was really hot and wanted to get with her. And she had to be like, why, no, Sailor, I'm a married woman.
My
And,
mom
like,
too. There's a quote with a man walking, driving his wheelchair past her room. This guy would drive past her room very slowly. He's like, he's trying to see me naked. And that one there, he's just trying to see my bug.
like you did such a great job of celebrating like those moments, and it's something I struggle with, right? Because even when she tells those stories, I'm like, my mom was a badass corporate bitch, right? Like, my mom was the president of the Northern California HR Association forever. Like, she was great in many ways, but she was never lewd. She was never the one telling the tap that ass story. How did you get to that place of Zen and being able to celebrate and be excited and embrace the becoming rather than what she was?
Well, here's the thing. My mom, if she had the resources and the opportunity, she would have been a stand-up comic. And it's one of the things that I recognized about myself in my own stand-up comedy is that I'm addicted to humor. I'm addicted to hearing people laugh. I'm addicted to making people laugh. I did my first show of 2022 last night, and my first joke killed so beautifully. The audience was with me from the moment I walked out, and I was just like, I had to fight back tears because it's such a beautiful feeling. That you're affecting these people and making them breathe. When you're laughing, you're breathing. And that first joke is always, I always make fun of myself first. So then, therefore, we can make fun of each other. And it just makes the evening flow better. And it's just a comedic thing. But my mother used to have every stand-up comedy album on vinyl and on 8-track. And she would play them on loop. She was also a master at electricity. She would string speakers together inside the house, into every room, out into the yard, out into the garden, in the chicken coop, were listening to Johnny Cash. All those chickens were just like jamming out to Johnny Cash,
All
but
boys and
they're also
suits.
listening to Joan Rivers at the same time. So she had Joan Rivers, George Carlin, Eddie Murphy, Robin Williams, Whoopi Goldberg, Dom DeLuise, Don Rickles, anybody who had a comedy album from the 60s and 70s, my mother had it and listened to it incessantly. And even in the 80s, like all through the 80s, when VHSs came out, she bought every single one, Whoopi Goldberg stand up, Louis Anderson stand up, Robin Williams, every single thing, Billy Crystal. She would memorize the jokes. She would memorize the science of telling the joke and then repeat it. And we worked in a factory together when I was younger. I used to go to high school until noon, then I would sign out since when I was a sophomore, junior, senior. And I would go work with her in the factory to help support the family. And then my senior year, I would sign out at noon, go to the factory, work until 7, and then go to college classes in theater at the local college. So I was starting college before I even graduated high school. And it wasn't that I was smart. It was just I knew I wanted to do something other than work in a factory, get married, have kids, and live in Pennsylvania. I've had my eye on New York City my whole childhood. Every school trip, every time I came here with my cousins, every Broadway show, I'm like, this is where I need to be. This is my city. And it was, it was just no way of doing that. But getting back to your question, as I would sit there sometimes and I would be fighting back tears, and then mom would do something. There was one time she pulled out a rolled up dollar bill, and I was like, oh shit, what are you doing? It looked like she was doing cocaine, but it was she rolled a roll of Rolaids around a dollar bill, the dollar bill she won in bingo. And she was showing me that she won a dollar in bingo. But I was like, what the hell are you doing, cocaine? And so, but she did stuff like she used to hide silverware in her underwear drawer. And I would go in to put her laundry away, and I would be, Mom, there's like an entire set of silverware in your panties. Why are you doing this? But it made me chuckle. It made me laugh. It made me smile because even though I was watching her fade away little by little, those little nuggets became my salvation. They became me breathing. I would laugh. And I found that when I was doing those menial tasks, like putting her socks away, putting her underwear away, getting her in and out of the bathroom and things like that, I would be stiff and I would be holding my breath and I wouldn't be happy. I would be, in this sort of like, just, it's kind of like twilight, like I just wasn't there. And then she would say something, do something, and it would just take me out of it. That was her coping mechanism. It was also her technique when we were little. So she had it even through her dementia to change the energy of the room. Just like, the singer quote, she's like, they went to see a singer, and I was like, Mom, how was the singer? He couldn't sing for shit. A fucking cat in heat was sing better, and took me right out of my sadness and brought me back to it. But I remembered to write everything down, and I would either post it right then and there because I would forget it. And I was like, this is comedy gold. I got to put this out there. It made me relax, but it also connected me with other people that were, that were just compassionate and understanding and had this, like they always said, you're a good son. And I loved hearing that. And I loved hearing, and I was like, yes, I'm a good son. I get it. I know it. I know it. My mom is, I would do anything for my mom. I would buy my mom anything, no matter what I could, if I could afford it, I would buy it for her. She wanted, there was one, she wanted sports bras for some reason. So I'm like, I'm getting you sports bras. So I bought her sports bras. And she's like, what the hell are these? And I said, they're sports bras. You asked for them. I'm not wearing that shit. I was like, okay, so I guess we're donating them. But there were just little moments of clarity where I was able to use my cell phone, and I could either go into the bathroom and type it, or type it in front of her, or film it, film her saying stuff. Even though a lot of the video that I do have of her is none of the funny stuff, it's just like I was waiting for the funny stuff to come out, and it just didn't come out. And by the time she'd said something, it was gone. But I would also voice auto dictate into my notes section of my phone what she just said. And as I was doing that, I didn't realize I was writing a book. I had no idea. But it brought me back to when I was a kid, and she was my protector, and now I'm her protector. And she was my, guide and, my boss. And now I'm her guide and her boss. And I'm, I took on the parental role. And it's hard because you're also a parent. You've got, jobs, kids, getting the kids ready for school, getting, this, that, and the other thing. And, I don't have that, but I also feel like you're juggling things and you always want to make that phone call every day just to make sure that she hears your voice. I knew she would behave when she saw, when she heard my voice, she would behave. The nurse would call me. One time she had gone to the ER and she had an IV in her arm and she was trying to yank it out. And the nurse called me and said, she will not stop picking at the IV. I put it in four times. I don't know what else to do. And I and the quote's in the book. And I said to her, "The mom, the nurse says you're trying to pull the IV out of your arm. What's going on?" "I ain't doing that. She's fucking lying. You know, like, I didn't do that." You know, and then I'm dealing with a 5-year-old. But then there are times of clarity where she'll remember dates, times. She remembered my birthday the day after, but she still remembered my birthday. She knew me, and she knew my cousin, and she knew my brother. Then there were some distant cousins that would call, and she sort of knew who they were. And then she would start to see people in the home that she thought were relatives. They resembled relatives. My cousin Angelina had passed away, and one of the activities directors looked exactly like Angelina. So mom would say, "Look who's working here now," and she'd point her and point to this woman, and I'm like, "Oh, okay, who's that?" And she's like, "It's your cousin Angelina. What are you talking about?" You know. So ironically, you look just like my cousin Angelina, which is really it's kind of spooky. But yeah, the having the footing to just ground yourself and say, "Okay, she's going through what she's going through." And the other thing with dementia patients and Alzheimer's patients is you have to live in their reality. You can't, or try, I try not to, I tried not to at least, question their reality, because all it does is confuse them. And then when they realize that they're talking about a person who's dead as if they were alive, and they're like, you know, the one thing that made me go ashen and just get chills was my mom was talking about my grandma, and I said, "Oh, she's working. She's at the restaurant. She's working." And then an hour later, she's like, "I think you lied to me. I think your grandmother's not with us anymore. Something's telling me that she's not with us anymore." And I said, "No, mom, she died in 1997, quite a long time ago." And she got very, very sad. And it was just better. Not necessarily to it's a white lie, but it's like it's better to live in their reality. It's like waking up a sleepwalker, you know.
Hard,
It's
yeah,
that.
it is hard for me because I have a deep need to be right all the time, Bobby. And so when she says something that is just, demonstrably wrong, it I have to battle everything in me. But what makes it worse is my kids are like, because I don't know how to explain to them, right? Hey guys, grandma's it's okay for grandma to be wrong, and we're just gonna roll with whatever grandma says. She's like, grandma, that's not right. Like, because so she'll forget which cousins live where, or she'll forget when she saw somebody, or like she forgot that it was Christmas on Christmas. And my kids were like, mama, grandma got confused again. She thought it wasn't Christmas. She crazy. And I'm like, let's roll with that. And she gets embarrassed and she gets upset and she retreats like they do. And it's, but it, I think that every time my kids see it, that's the hardest. Like
Oh,
I
God,
can control me, but like I hate seeing that. So you have so much like compassion and so much zen about this. Like I feel like, I'm talking to my therapist about we have conversations about it's okay to mourn, even though there is still a physical entity that looks like your mom, like all those types of things. How did the guy who ran away from home to join the circus literally turn into this Zen master of death and grieving and
A lot of
finding humor in all
drugs.
it?
No, I'm teasing.
I mean,
No,
I'm down.
the thing that I will say that was really, you go through life and you want to be the best you can be. So I was always gravitating towards the next thing. It's like I was a master at pivoting. And circus came along because I had come to New York to be an actor. And I got a full scholarship to the American Musical and Dramatic Academy. So I was here for a while, working on theater, doing dancing, singing, acting, tap dancing. I was a great tap dancer. I had been doing ballroom dance. Ballroom dance is how I got into theater professionally. I got a scholarship to the Strasbourg Ballet Theater in Pennsylvania. And they needed men for well, all every dance school needs men. Just putting that out there. No matter where you are in the world, every dance school, there's three times the number of women as there are men.
Believe me, the local ballet school, so the Austin Ballet, gives free lessons to boys.
Sure.
And my oldest, whom he currently prefers Captain Sparkle Pants as his nomicker du jour,
Okay.
is very keen. He really wants to be Billy Elliot at five. Like, that's the dream. And I'm like, I feel like you're five, and the ballet school is really far away. I don't know if I'm that good of a mom yet. But yeah, so I am aware that, like,
I
it's a
think
thing.
there's plenty of YouTube tutorials that if he really wanted to, you could do something together. You could learn together.
There are lots of
And
local dance schools that are 5 minutes away that he can learn from. And then if he has actual acumen and ongoing interest, then mommy can make the hour drive one way to get him developed.
Right. And I agree with you there. I also feel like he's five.
Yeah.
You know, I if I mean, I will say this, I knew at three that I wanted to be a dancer because I remember being in our first house. We moved in from Stroudsburg up to Ravioli Mountain, which is the title of
Little
my
cookbook,
second book.
yes.
We moved, and I remember being 3 years old in the old house and 4 years old in the other house. So I was 3 years old. We were watching West Side Story, and I never saw boys dance. And I said, "Why are they doing that?" You know. And my mom said, "They're boys dance. They dance like this in this movie." And then later, 70s rolled around, and we got Saturday Night Fever. We got Grease. We got Staying Alive. We got all these different images and musical movies. And then, of course, all of the old Fred Astaire movies were playing every Saturday night. So I got to see men dancing, but in a very masculine way, in a very, beautiful, romantic way. And then in West Side Story, it was very hard hitting. You know, it became like this, it's like there are these chess pieces that they were moving in a battle. I didn't understand it, but I knew that that was attractive to me. That was something that I was excited about. So, ballroom dance became first. Then I joined the circus world in 87, and I had been, I'd been really looking for the next thing because when you come to New York, 1980s, you sing like everybody, you look like everybody, you dance like everybody. And every redhead that came into that audition who was 5'5", I looked just like. But the difference was the minute I had circus and trapeze at the bottom of my resume, I was the one redhead that got called back. I was the one redhead that they kept in the room because they wanted to talk to me. They wanted to ask me questions about circus, trapeze. Where did you learn this? How did you do it? Would you be interested in doing it in our show? Blah, 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 blah. And that's how it bubbled up. And at that time, Equity Summer Stock, Actors Equity Union Summer Stock, was paying $250 a week. I left a $250 a week job, which was not the thing to do. You got an equity job, you stayed with it. But I left that job to go work in Las Vegas for $1,500 a week, doing circus. It was a skill. There was no, now there's like circus schools everywhere.
Cirque du Soleil has just completely changed everything, I think, in
They
that
changed
regard.
the map. They
Yeah.
changed the whole thing. And I also feel like it just morphed itself into something that is now, sadly, on the level. Not that there's anything wrong with yoga, but it's sadly, aerial arts is now sadly aligned with yoga. Like you go out onto the street and you trip over a yoga studio. You go out on the street and you trip over an aerial studio. So it's become this kind of like dumbed down thing that, when I started, there were only six acrobats in New York City. It was me and five women. And the women had the lion's share of the nightclub work. And that was where you made your living. That's where you made your money, working Webster Hall, Palladium, Shine, Limelight, all those big dance clubs. I had to wait. I had to wait until one of them was out and then I could jump into their spot. And then the producers of that nightclub would say, "Oh, there's a guy who does this too. Let's have him come back in." So it wasn't until until then that I really got into, you know, doing circus in different places. And I didn't travel that much as a circus artist. I made my living. I used to make my living in New York City on two nights a week. I used to make my rent in two nights a week. In Vegas, I had an enormous house that I rented. I think I paid $800 a month back then for a four bedroom house, but I was the only one living in it. But it was the only thing available. It was so cheap. And I literally like didn't have any furniture in the upstairs. I only had my bedroom. And I, you know, for 6 months, that's where I lived. I had this completely empty house. And that was, you know, 10 minutes from my job. I could be in my car downtown on the strip into the casino within 15 minutes, depending on traffic, in makeup and costume performing, and then be home by midnight. Or if it was a late show, I would be, you know, I'd be off all day and I could go train and practice and then sleep and then go do the night show. You know, so it's just varied from year to year and place to place.
You and your mom were so close at the end. Mm-hmm. Was there any time in all of this that her support faltered, where she was like, Bobby, maybe it's time for a day job. Am I right? Have you thought about banking? I hear banking is great.
When I decided to go to school for theater full time, my grandmother was like, shouldn't you go to school for computers? They're going to be big. And she was right.
Yeah.
But not I wrong. Said, no, that's not what I want to do. You know, and I also knew that I didn't want to give myself something to fall back on, because then I knew I'd fall back. I'm like, I'm either going to make it or I'm not coming back. You know, the other thing too, like mom was supportive up to a point. Grandma was supportive up to a point. Dad was the one that was sort of like proud of me. And he would, you know, when I would come visit from college, I would visit him at work and he would be like, oh, this is my son. He's going to his acting school in New York City, blah, 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 blah. You know, and, you know, so he was just tickled because he was a guitar player, you know, he was an artist. So he got it and he got why I wanted it so badly. So in a way, both my parents were artists in their own light and I was living through me. But they weren't supportive of it in the very beginning until I did a production of Singin' in the Rain, the musical. And it was a multi-million dollar production. It was beautiful. I was tap dancing in the chorus. I had, you know, multiple jobs in the show. And they all came up to see it. And it was my first, like, really big, you know, paying job that was not the local Shawnee Playhouse, or it wasn't the local, you know, Playhouse by the River, whatever those smaller houses were. You know, because those, you had to have a day job. They paid you $50 a week to be in the chorus. They weren't going to pay you a living wage to do theater back then. But for this particular show, they came up and they saw it and they were like, oh my God, this must be real. He's good. He's good at what he does. And right after that, I left and joined, and I went to Vegas. So it was like, they were like, wait a minute, didn't you just, but mom, look at the paycheck, you know? So they—
Did they come see you in Vegas?
No, they never did. Oh. They were going to, but I could only handle Vegas for 6 months. It's a rough town. It's not New York. It's very hot. And you can't do a lot of things in Vegas unless you're, you know, on the strip and you just, you know, you want to do casino, nightclub. And then there's Walmart, you know, so there's not a lot to do.
And casino, nightclub, Walmart. Those are your only three options.
Yeah, those are your options in Vegas.
In the 80s.
But now it's like a theme park. So now they have like, you know, water slides and roller coasters and all that stuff. But I didn't even want that. You know, the thing was, is that I was there to train and I was training with different acrobats too. So I was learning. But the thing that killed me, I'll never forget. We had these islands that had slot machines around them and used to go up on top and I would do my aerial act above the island. Well, I got up on there and I'm all the way up 30 feet in the air, hanging from a rope. And I look down and not one person is looking at me. They're all staring at the slot machines. And then one woman takes a cigarette and lights it into her trachea and looks up, blows the smoke out, and goes back to her thing. And I'm like, that's the key. That's exactly what I needed. I'm out of here. And within that, I found a way to go back to New York. I actually detoured from back to New York, and then the New York scene was still bubbling up, but then I sort of had to reintroduce myself. And then there was this new circus school that was opening in San Francisco. So a bunch of us moved to San Francisco to train with real hardcore circus folks. And that was, that was where that's where my skills really started to bounce up, and really I became more of a solid acrobat. But it's just like the twists and turns. Mom was there for it, but she, even in the end, she used to tell people that I was a gymnastics coach, which I was at one point. I made money coaching gymnastics in the early 2000s, because it was the first job to come up that I could use what skills I had. But yeah, she didn't remember that I worked in the circus. There's only one quote where she remembered I work in the circus, that, and it was just discussing an automation, the tool we call a pickle. So, but it was the one time that she remembered. She's like, "How do you use that in the circus?" And I was like, "Oh." For 5 years, she's been calling me a gymnastics coach, and now she finally remembers that. But there are many little snippets of clarity that comes and goes with dementia and Alzheimer's. And that there's times when you get to see the person that you grew up with, and then you get to see the person that they are. And it's very hard, but the thing is, the more that you detach from the emotion of the sadness, I found detaching from the sadness and just being present with her and living in her journey, go in her journey, and like, "Oh, mom, you have a 62 Edsel downstairs in the garage? Wow, I don't remember that car. Tell me about it." Bang. She went off from start to finish. It's green. It has velvet seats. It had the automatic lights. I mean, she knew, remembered, this was a real car that she had in 1962. But she, I didn't know anything about it. But then it came this journey of her telling all about the DeSoto. And then I find a photo of my mother standing in front of that car. And I got to tell you, and it was actually red. So, but it just brought me back to, that time period of, just go with her. Go with her on her journey. She's not, it's not, being right is not going to help the situation. It's going to make her
Oh, I
more
know.
frustrated, more sad, and more like I said, waking up a sleepwalker in shock. And
And I'm good for the journey the first time, Bobby, but it's on the fourth time in a row you've heard the car story. I'm just not that good of an actress. And so I'm like, "Oh, that's cool, Mom. Tell me about that." And then she tells you, and so she's in this place right now where she gets stuck in these loops with the story. And so you hear the same story
Ask
literally
her a
like
different
five
question.
times in
Ask her what her second car was. Ask her, where
I
did you go?
try, I try, but
I mean, you can
it's
try.
so hard, Bobby. It's so hard.
I know, but then
It's so hard.
what's the alternative?
Oh, I know.
The
I know. I
alternative
totally
is you don't have much time left with her.
get it. I know.
So you'll pray for those loops. You'll be, even though they frustrate you now, they're like gold. My mother was she definitely got into the loops. She definitely had the looping. She had that. That was one of the first things that we noticed in 2009, was that she was repeating herself. And I get nervous when I repeat myself, so I'm like, "Oh, tick tock, tick tock."
That was the first thing we noticed, actually, because my mom's mom died of early onset Alzheimer's. And so, because that tends to be hereditary, my mom was terrified always that she would be exactly where she is, right? And so she, anytime there was some random article with some new wackadoodle proof positive way to make sure you don't have the Alzheimer's. She was on it. So like there was something that was like when you early indications of Alzheimer's is you can't smell lemon. And so she literally went and like bought out a damn Bath and Body Works of all their
Oh,
lemon
God.
scented shit. She was like, I can smell lemons. I'm like, Mom, chill. This is not what the same thing with like there was another one that said the same thing about the smell of leather. So like
Yeah.
she all the cars had to have leather seats so that she could smell the leather. And she bought her dad, like both her and my dad, leather jackets. And I was like, just rein it in. And then like one was like peanut, the taste of peanut butter. And just like all of these, I mean, you must know, like all of the crazy articles that come out that somebody posts, it's like,
Always.
yes. And then
There's
all of
always
a
something
sudden,
new.
yes. And then all of a sudden it stopped. And she stopped doing anything that might test. And she retreated. And when we finally coaxed her out of the corner, we had the loops. We had,
Yeah.
couldn't remember, did she eat today? Couldn't remember, like all of like the all
Yeah, also
the
eating was an issue because when she moved in with me, I would have to go to work in the afternoon. So I would either I worked day shift on Mondays and then I worked Tuesday through Friday at night. So when I left for the day on Monday, what I would do over the weekend was I would make little omelet cups, omelet muffins in the muffin tin. So you basically just fill the muffin tins with filling like bacon and cheese or whatever, and then pour egg, bake it for 20 minutes, and then put two of them in the microwave for 20 seconds. She's got a hot breakfast. And she couldn't eat more than two of them. They were very, it was a great little way that I knew she was going to eat. And then I would come home from work and they would be gone. Or they wouldn't be gone. They would still be there. I'm like, Mom, you forgot to eat. You didn't eat lunch. You didn't eat breakfast. What'd you do? And I would call her and say, did you eat breakfast? And she would say, yes. And so it became, I had to put it down in front of her before I left for work. So then I had to change my routine. When I was getting my coffee, I put four of the eggs in the microwave, gave two to her, two to me, and we would sit together. It became our ritual. And then if she missed lunch, or if I would call her and I'd say, did you eat lunch? And she's like, yeah, of course I did. You didn't eat, did you eat the sandwich I left for you? You left me a sandwich. And I'm like, no. Oh, go. I said, get up, go to the refrigerator. And then she would eat. And then that would be the way. And then, but then it just got to be like, if I did not put it down in front of her, she would not take care of herself. And same way at the nursing home, there were times when if they did not sit with her, she wouldn't eat. So it wasn't that they force fed her. There were a
No.
lot of times that she was just, she was definitely hungry. She definitely had her sense of hunger. But it was a process. And I will say that, never arguing is a key. Diffusing the arguments is a key. There's times when they're sad. There's times when they're crying. There's times when they want to just hug a teddy bear. Getting my mother's sister also died of COVID in the pandemic, and she died a few months later, in 2020 December, and she had definitely Alzheimer's. She did not have dementia, so the difference of the two is it was explained to me that if you show a set of keys to a person with dementia, they know that they're keys. They just don't know which key opens what lock. If you show it to somebody who has Alzheimer's, they don't know what keys are. So my aunt Betty re reverted back to a child, and she had a teddy bear that she would feed and talk, and she would talk to the teddy bear. And my cousin would post these videos of my aunt talking to a teddy bear. And it wasn't like, oh, ha ha, look, she's crazy. It was like, this is the reality. And when I saw that, it was like two totally different things. Like, these are two women who grew up in the same house, grew up the same time. And here's my mother who remembers who I am, who remembers names of people and things like that, just doesn't know what time period it is. And then there's my Aunt Betty who was just like a child, feeding a teddy bear. So those images of how different the disease can be and the types of diseases. And ironically and sadly, I know this is morbid, but the only way you can find out and be diagnosed for either is if there's an autopsy on your brain. That's the and that and there's no way of checking. You can see different shrinkage in the brain in scans and things like that, but there's no way of testing. But it definitely is a it's a process. I say for me, sticking to the humor, finding the humor in everything, not only just her, but my life. You know, finding a way to laugh every single day is what saved me. And also making other people laugh, getting stand up back into my life. I did stand up on Zoom and it was awful. And then when I got back in front of an audience in November, and then last night, like I said, nothing feeds my soul like comedy. And if there is a heroin or a crack or anything like that, drug for me, it's
It's
definitely
laughter.
laughter.
Well, I think your book is definitely feeding the world all of your crack, if that's the case. So I
Thank
cannot
you.
believe we are already out of
Oh my
time.
God, I talk so fast.
No, it's this has been
Thank
amazing. What
you.
have we not talked about that we need to?
Oh wow. Let's see.
We'll
Let me
have
just
all
do
the
the
links
laundry
to the
list.
books
All
and
the links to the
you
book.
and all of that will be in the show notes.
Coming soon, I'm in editing hell, is Escape to Ravioli Mountain, a memoir in food, recipes
So
and amusing
excited.
anecdotes from growing up in a dysfunctional Italian family on a mountaintop in rural Pennsylvania.
I am so
That's a, I
excited for
wanted the
that one
title to be a
coming.
mouthful. So
I am excited.
basically, like the pandemic happened, mom died, and I'm an artist, I'm a trapeze artist. I don't have a trapeze in my living room. And also, there's no way to do art, there's no way to make art. So I started writing, and I'm not a writer, I'm not an editor, I'm not a chef, but I wrote these two books on my own. I self-published as well. I encourage people to talk about self-publishing, look into self-publishing. You make 60% of your income of the cost of the book. You make 60% of your book if you produce it on Amazon or publish it on Amazon. If you publish it through a publishing house, you get a small percentage, but you get a different distribution. But the bottom line is that I did it myself. I put myself out there. I surrounded myself with good people. Coming soon, I mean, the next thing for me is 1 month from today, I will be in the Queer Comedy Festival again. It's my second time around with them in the Village Comedy Club on April 21st.
Oh, how exciting.
And then last night, I was just at the Muse for their open stages variety show. So my stand-up is brewing. There's a whole show of impressions. I do an entire show singing impressions. And it's called Bitter Party of 50 that I'm working on. So I'm building up these different moments that go into the show. Plus there's a whole 5 minute set about Shit My Mama Says. And it could be a TED talk if I wanted it to be.
I love it.
Connecting to people like you, connecting to people who do podcasts is also healing to be able to talk about that. You know, like I said, you relive the trauma, but it eventually dials back and you become at peace with it. You become at peace with where you what you experienced. And you know, they say time heals everything. Well, nothing will heal the loss of my mom or my dad, really. I didn't know my dad that well, you know, because he died when I was so young. But you know, I miss my mom every day, but she's with me every day. This is a way that I get to see her face every day. I get to talk to her every day if I want to. I get to hear her voice in my head every day. And she is educating the children worldwide. So
Thank you so much for letting me and my audience be part of your healing. This has been great. Thank you so much,
thank
Bobby.
you. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Hey, I Want Your Job. For more information on how you can get your own awesome job, visit ONH Consulting at www.onhconsulting.com. We offer incredible resumes, no-nonsense career advice, and real-world tips for landing a job in today's market. Check us out on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Insta for more insider information. Soon, you'll be hearing us say, I'm Michelle Olivier, and hey, I want your job.